This Media Voices special is sponsored by Flume Training. Flume believe the way clients buy has completely shifted and what works in sales has completely changed. They help media businesses drive sales performance through their high-impact training, coaching, and consultancy. As the duopoly hoovers up digital spend, consumers get pissed off, marketers start asking difficult questions about performance, and print sales remain stubbornly flat, is it time for publishers to find another way to pay the bills, or are there still opportunities in display advertising sales? To discuss the prognosis for advertising sales, I'm joined today by Fergus Gregory, formerly of Informa and now Group Commercial Director at global marketing media powerhouse The Drum, and Raoul Monks, founder of Flume, whose company delivers sales performance training, coaching and consulting to a client list that includes Haymarket, Wilmington and Centaur. So to begin with then, Fergus, just wanted to ask you, what do you think of this opening question? How do you feel about our headline question? Is advertising more hassle than it's worth? Not necessarily a yes or no answer, just how do you actually feel about that?
As a man whose life has largely been devoted to driving advertising revenue, it does sometimes seem like a bit of a Sisyphean task, to be honest. But the truth is, I'm an optimist, and there is plenty of opportunity to drive profitable growth from advertising. I mean, certainly, if you're working for Amazon, you know, they're reported as expecting $3.37 billion from ads in 2018, as it is. But for the rest of us, I think we should probably start by defining advertising a little bit more. And I did the wonderful thing and looked this up on Wikipedia. But it'll ring true with many.
Advertising as.
Yeah, exactly. The act or practice of calling public attention to one's product, service, et cetera, by paid announcement. Mm. So for me, that's not just display advertising. And I would argue if you ever put all your reliance on one channel, it's going to be a hassle. You're on a hide into nothing. So yes, plenty of opportunity in using display as part of the mix.
And Roel, what do you think? Is the sentiment that advertising has been harder over the past couple of years real, but there is still pessimism, that there is still opportunity here, that there's still room for optimism?
Yeah, I think there is pessimism. I hear it a lot from people that we work with. And my take on it is that there is still very much a place for it. The point of it being a hassle, Fergus define the word advertising, I'd maybe define a word hassle. So what I mean by that is there's different layers of hassle. So one of the hassle layers is for the publishers, and that actually for them, there's lots of different technology out there that they could potentially make money out of. And so actually trying to make money out of advertising like they used to, it's become more difficult because clients fundamentally are probably finding it more hassle to actually justify the spend on advertising. And that's because of the differences in terms of measurability, justification. If you go by CEB's figures, 6.8 people involved in every single decision-making process, it's harder for them to actually buy stuff than it used to be if they can't qualify and quantify that it's actually going to work. So there's more hassle because it takes a different approach to actually sell this stuff. Yeah. You can't get by just by saying, right, here's a page advert, or here is a banner, or here is a MPU, whatever it is that you're used to selling. It needs to be focused on helping that person in the client's business justify this stuff. So my take is it's probably more hassle if you're trying to do it how you used to do it, but actually done in a different way, in the way that clients need you to do it. It can be the same amount of effort, but it can have even higher returns than it used to.
Yeah, so I mean, I kind of agree with that hassle side of things, and one of the areas where certainly when this trend started, publishers were somewhat blindsided by some of the tech solutions that were out there, and I think hassle came into that because one of the big messages for marketers and agencies was, hey, all that stuff you've been doing for years doesn't work. We've got this shiny new thing over here that does, and it's much easier for you. You don't have to deal with all of those horrible, nasty advertising salespeople. Just buy it online. But the pendulum swung that way for a long time. But I think concerns like brand safety and ad fraud have really brought context back to the fore. I think legislation has also brought first party data back. You know, without mentioning the hackneyed GDPR, I'll mention it, and e-privacy coming up. So for traditional publishers, suddenly I think this swings the pendulum of opportunity way back towards them, actually. If you're dealing in first party data and you're dealing in safe environments, you're creating almost your own walled gardens, and I think the knowledge bases within publishers has actually caught up. Sometimes the salespeople need to catch up as well.
mean, just in terms of those salespeople, it's a really interesting journey we're kind of going on at the moment of Flume and seeing what's working and what's not. And for us, we're kind of seeing a shift in terms of selling that advertising when it's actually working and those revenue streams are growing. What the sales teams are actually being tooled up with in their businesses is the ability to help clients make the advertising work and have the right impact on the audience. Whereas I think 10 years ago, it was here's an advert, good luck, don't have to measure it or can't measure it, part science, part religion, and hoping that it kind of works. Whereas now it has to work. And so actually, the really clever publishers, what they're doing is helping their sales team not just sell the advertising they've got, but make that advertising work for the audience they're trying to reach. And so there's this kind of shift from salespeople getting into the client's head, which is kind of where it was 5, 10 years ago. Now it's getting the client into the audience's head and helping the client make it easier for their audience to choose from them. And that's a real skill that salespeople can develop. And it's a real skill that's helping sales to people to stand out.
So it's almost a process of re-education, not just for the publishers who had to relearn the fact that they did have this great advantage, not in terms of, you know, first party data obviously, but in terms of the relationship that they had with their audience, but in terms of how publishers and kind of sales teams can approach, well, audiences and consumers both.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've seen a again a big shift from some of the more savvy publishers out there from just understanding their data in terms of geography, demographics, and we speak to a lot of publishers who know so much about their audience, but actually, all the clients care about is how does that audience make decisions and how can I influence that decision? And the stronger publishers out there who are having real impact in terms of the advertising side of things are the ones who are able to teach their clients around how to have the biggest impact on that audience, which means it's actually shifting from just audience data to audience behavior, and really understanding how that audience makes decisions and understanding how to influence it so that that sales team can become an expert to actually make the decision for the client much easier.
So I sat in on a conversation the other day with Keith Weed of Unilever, and we were talking about if you could look back from, you know, 50 years in the past, or rather if you could look forward from 50 years in the past and say, you know, what are the great advantages that we want to retain? There was the implication came up that maybe there has been a slight shift in where consumers put their trust. So was advertising much easier, say, over the last couple of decades when there was kind of the perception that brands were more trusted?
I think I don't know that it did. I don't know. I like to think that things were easier in the good old
Do you
days.
think it's literally just that
But
kind of halcyon mindset?
yeah, I think there is because we just had different challenges. What's really interesting is that we can now provide advertisers way more of what they always said they needed. However, you know, we also have tools that can give better indication of what is and isn't resonating, for example. I mean, you can even get it down to the sort of the creative level, and it can inspire what's going on at that level. And if something doesn't seem to work, I don't know, it just seems harder because we've all put a lot of faith in the technology. And like for a long time, the industry seemed to focus on the tech rather than the outcomes,
Yeah, I see.
And what we were trying to get the audience to do differently. And marketing and good advertising has always been about getting to either change perceptions or change behaviors, right? And ultimately, you really want to change behaviors at the end of it. So I do think there are clearly some trust issues and obviously some notable screw ups right the way across the board, right? I don't necessarily see this being a particularly massive issue for premium publishers. In fact, it could be a real opportunity. So as publishers continue to invest as they always have done in the environment and in truly understanding what's important about their audience, to go to Raoul's point, not just everything about their audience, what really, really matters. The biggest issue I see from the marketing side of things is trust issues with technology. The ad tech space is a notable bloodbath at the moment, right?
You would have thought that it would be quieting down now, but it's not. There are still these controversies that come out everywhere. I saw one on the Drum just the other day, actually, about ad caching, which is just bid caching rather, which is just insane that that practice is still ongoing.
It is, and you know, the best way of doing it is describing it, I think, is murky to say the least. But there are some real premium players in there, and those are the guys that you hear from a lot. And I was chatting with one of them actually, and they funded a recent study into CMOs to find trust levels. And what came out of that was quite damning, I think, for everyone involved in that ecosystem. Some 60% of CMOs didn't trust programmatic advertising enough to invest more in it.
Yeah, I can believe that.
It's damning, right? And But this could and should be the opportunity to take the higher ground for premium publishers.
Yeah.
So they've got a trusted environment, they've got years and years of working and delivering results for customers. So they can actually lead the way, and we are seeing some do that in helping programmatic space to clean up its act. So the marketers have spoken. If the publishers start to show ways of actually cleaning up, you'll get the tech players following and the agencies following as well.
So does that in turn almost simplify the sales process, because the message has become, again, this is about trusted environment and content that really resonates with an audience?
I think in theory, yes, it should do. Yeah. It doesn't mean it always does. There's some real interesting things around. I mean, a lot of what we do at Flume is work with companies to help who appeal or go out to B2B audiences. Mm. So we talk around working with their sales teams to help them learn more about that audience behavior, to teach their clients how to make the best decisions. But actually, what's really interesting about trust is you've got this kind of lowering of trust because of technology, like you said. But actually, the paradox is that trust is in B2B more important than it's ever been before.
Yeah.
To the point, I'm reading a white paper recently, which is written by CEB, now Gartner, and Google, called From Promotion to Emotion. And that talks about how trust levels in B2B, because of the risk of making a bad decision, the amount of people involved in the decision, putting your head in a parapet, how it's easier to not go with a new decision. The trust levels in a brand need to be twice as high in B2B as they are in B2C.
Mm.
That's quite kind of counterintuitive. You'd imagine it's the other way around, but actually because of that risk, it means that trust when they're choosing a client is more important than ever before. So there's this desperate need for the audience to trust, but actually there's this technology working against that kind of trust level. So there is a real opportunity there for that sales experience to help that client get that trust across and help that audience trust. So that there's a big opportunity there for salespeople. And when you look at the stats as to why clients choose one opportunity over another, so let's say X company, won't name any, over another company in terms of advertising solution, a stunning stat is that 53% of why they're going to choose is down to the sales experience.
Yeah.
19% is the actual product and service.
That seems insanely high.
Yeah, it's crazy, right? So they're actually only 19% of why they're choosing your solution is down to the solution. 53% is because of the sales experience. And what that is because of is because the sales experience is where the trust comes from.
Mm.
Because if that sales experience is providing that experience for the wrong reasons, i.e. to make themselves money, they can't sell that on. It's never going to be something they trust. If the sales experience is there because it's created and designed to help the client make better decisions and get better results, and there's that trust level, it's much easier for them to buy into it, much easier for them to sell on. So this trust thing, the interesting bit is actually the trust is now being provided by the sales experience. Mm. The problem is a lot of salespeople out there, and I think the media sales and event sales landscape, as a salesperson 10 years ago, my motivation was just to hit my target.
Mm.
Whereas the motivation now needs to be to hit your target by helping your client hit the target. And if you've got that genuine motivation and the company has that genuine motivation, then those trust levels can skyrocket.
So we spoke at the start, we defined advertising, we defined hassle. I think at this point it might be worth almost defining trust and what that looks like in a B2B sales space.
Mm.
So is it affinity, or is it a sort of this kind of realignment with a audience's targets and goals?
I think with that in a B2B space, yeah. if you're a salesperson and you're looking to sell on, or indeed actually, and I'll sales experience is super important, but actually the marketing experience we're finding is really, really important as well.
Yeah, because good
point. We work with organizations, the largest in the world to, you know, small agencies who need to influence other marketers. So these are B2B marketers who are trying to inspire other marketers to buy their products and services. That's a tough gig.
Yeah.
Right? Expectations are high. And the marketing landscape is one which is actually similar. I've seen across a ton of other B2B landscapes. The choice for a B2B buyer out there is more than ever before. I mean, we could say in the marketing space, there's a MarTech 5000. All of those, you can't even read all those suppliers on one sort of, you know, whatever it is, the version of the Lumascape, right?
It scares me every time I even think about it now.
And imagine being a buyer in that space, and you've got this whole thing of everybody's part-time marketer, thanks to the likes of, you know, LinkedIn. And so you're under pressure internally from all of your colleagues. Why aren't we doing something on Snap? What's this new crazy thing we've got to do? And you've got to make the right decision. So that's really, really tough. For marketers in that environment, you start building trust really, really early. You start convincing them, you know, and you become much more integrated with the B2B sales funnel than ever before. So I think it's a great opportunity for marketers.
One of the things around trust that we have seen is trust comes from, let's step back, get into the head of a client who's buying off one of your sales team, right? For the client, they need to trust that they are not going to lose credibility by trying to push this decision through, that they're not going to lose time and they're not going to lose their blooming job. I mean, there is that risk. If they make a bad enough decision to spend $100,000 on a campaign and it doesn't work, that is very, very risky for them. So what that links to is actually what they need to grow trust is it's around belief, right? They need to believe that that sales experience is and advice is coming for the right reasons. But actually what that simplest way to think about this is they need to believe in why they should choose one thing, as opposed to 10 years ago, where all they'd ever be hearing is what they should choose. And because of the way they have to make decisions, which is to convince all of these other stakeholders, the only question they're going to be asking is, well, why is this going to work? Why do we need to even change from what we're doing at the moment? So those trust levels come from a conversation where the sales person and marketing people are not talking necessarily about what they're selling. It's about why the client should buy in a certain way, why the client should change from what they're doing at the moment. It's much more of an educational approach. So that trust, for me, the kind of definition is, I suppose, a collaboration where both minds, the client and the sales slash marketing, are lining up to focus on why certain things are right, as opposed to just what.
So how recently did we go from the what to the why? You know, how recently is this, has this sea change occurred?
I would say since the 2008 to 2009, since there's kind of a big change in risk, without going into too much detail. But if you look at, again, the research, there was a great book, if anyone hasn't read it, called The Challenger Sale, which is by CEB. That came out, I think, 2012. And at that point, the stat was 5.4 decision makers in each decision, which obviously has a massive impact on the emotional connection that a client has to have with you, because they need to feel safe in terms of convincing these people. 2 years ago, that went up to 6.8, or had reached 6.8. And I heard a figure recently, I think, I don't know if it's yourself, Fergus, who mentioned this, but a figure where it's gone above 7 now. So it is still progressing and probably isn't going to see an end in the next couple of years. So I don't think that kind of sea change is going to go the other way. But I also have very, very varied experiences of publishers who accept that that's changing and accept that therefore what the sales people need to do is changing and what works is changing, but others who still like to believe that one day it'll either turn back or there is no difference and you can keep doing what you used to do. But as we've seen, that doesn't necessarily work anymore.
I can think of a single example over the last couple of years of either publishers or sales teams who've stuck their head in the sand that won't come up the better for it. You know, you talk about some publishers who found themselves accidentally in the right place at the right time, but that doesn't seem to be a long-term strategy, to say the least.
No.
And both of you have a lot of understatement. Both of you have an awful lot of contact with, you know, marketers, with advertisers. So apart from that noise, apart from the kind of the interruptive nature of sales sometimes, what are some of the big challenges that advertising and sales teams are facing now?
Honestly, I think it goes back to the buy side again. Frankly, it's easier not to speak to you. I can, as a marketer, right? And marketers are in demand. Yeah, there was a stat a few years back I read about CMOs and the tenure of a CMO being something scary like 18 months or something like that. Actually, I expected that to get shorter because you expect these things to get shorter. But actually, the tenure of a CMO is starting to get longer again. And it's interesting. In the tech space, it's still pretty brutal. But if you look overall, the tenure of CMOs is beginning to rise again from the research that I did, which really surprised me actually. And I asked around as to why people thought that might be. And marketing talent is at a premium. It really is, particularly successful marketing talent, and because the ability for marketers to influence the sale, even in B2B, right the way through to, you know, the money end of it. means that more and more people are investing more and more in technology, and they need marketers to drive it, because you can't just bring in a marketing automation system and expect it to work, right?
Yeah.
You end up having to invest with a ton more people with different skills, and you need a CMO who can understand what that means, and a CMO who properly understands the realities of search and so on and so forth. And so I think from the buy side, you cannot get the sack, going back to the original question, you cannot get the sack by doing loads of stuff that doesn't involve speaking with a salesperson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? You can try new things. You can do what you've always done, because no one ever got the sack for doing, well, we've always done this, right? And yeah. I will keep doing it. It's not my fault that sales numbers are going down. It's sales' fault.
Yeah, exactly. Right? I want it to change.
But so this is not only driven by that plethora of choice, actually. There's a hell of a lot more complexity in decision-making, as Raoul said. And it is much easier not to stick your head above the parapet and just get on with what you've always done than it is to go out and make a stand. And in some cases, I've seen it, it's a bit like a mild form of post-traumatic stress disorder, right, in big corporates. I think it, from a salesperson's perspective, we've got to become almost like coaches that help our champions internally overcome risk-averse, corporate inertia.
Yeah.
They need to be really good at finding the right client-side champions. So getting the right person to champion your cause is a huge bit, and a follow-on from the CEB book, The Challenger Customer, which looked at
mobilizers
is really, really interesting. And actually, you know, from my experience, we find that to be largely true in real life, which is nice. But also, you got to give salespeople time, that means. You clearly need to upskill, but for a numbers game, for a salesperson to pay off, you need a lot of potential champions all working on your behalf. And that means you've got to work probably doubly as hard as you did in the past, and truly understand your customers rather than necessarily using some of the more traditional methods.
So is now the time really that there has to be a reappraisal of what it means to be an effective sales individual, effectively, as well as part of a team?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and kind of linking back actually to something Fergus said just then. At Flume, we've got a deep belief that if a sales team carries on selling in the same way that 10, 15 years ago was working, a lot of the time, probably 90% of the time, they will be challenged in terms of lots of issues that will create themselves, i.e. not being able to get into the door of that person because they don't want to pick up the phone, or massively long decision making. And actually, the reason why is exactly what you've just said there, Chris, which is what it means to be in sales today has totally changed. And the reason why is because the way buyers buy has changed. Great example. We see that a lot of media professionals, salespeople, and marketers are very, very good at shouting about their products, shouting about their solutions, what they can do, why they're the best, why they're the biggest. The issue is that, again, looking at some of the research from Gartner, there's a great stat, although a very scary one, that says 86% of B2B buyers do not see a big enough difference between one option and another to pay more for it, which means only 14% of B2B buyers actually, is that maths right? Yeah, 14% of B2B buyers actually see a difference between your option and another. And put it into publisher world, the reason why is because your sales team and marketing team are probably saying three things. We've got the best brand, we've got the best audience, we've got the best content. Next person phones up that client, they're probably saying the same thing. So actually, by focusing on we're the best, we're the biggest, we're the oldest, whatever it might be, i.e. this is why you should choose us, it doesn't make it in any way easy for the client to buy. Actually, it makes it tougher because they're hearing you're just like these ones. Hey, I can probably get away without this, or let's go into a price war. If you look at what works today, what works is mapping the sales process to the buying process. So the sales process, let's flip that. The buying process is not, ooh, I'm happy using this. Oh, there's something new, let's buy it. The buying process is, I'm using this, actually, it's causing me issues. I'm not happy using this. I can't keep using this. So step number one in the buying process is, I've got to change from my status quo. Step two is, oh, what should I choose? I like that. That's going to work. I believe it's going to work and get me results. At that stage, you've got, I need to change, this is what I need to choose. But it's one person, normally one main person, making that decision. You've then got this bit afterwards, which, name it what you want, the selling on stage, championing in their business, where that person then has to repeat that process to the other 5.8 decision makers they have to influence. So they've got to influence those other 5.8. Why should we change? Why should we choose? And that's a hell of a big game for them and a lot of effort. when a sales team is just focusing on that middle bit, they haven't got a client to think, I'm brave enough to put my head above the parapet and say, actually, I need to change. We've got to change now. They aren't necessarily confident in you as a solution because they see you the same as everyone else. Mm. And salespeople think when they've sent a proposal out, hey, my job's done. But actually, that's kind of where the tough work starts, because you need to be putting your arm around your client who's equally convinced you that they need to change and choose and help them sell on. So the buying process shouldn't be help them choose and say we're the best. It should be help them change, help them choose and help them sell on or champion your recommendation in the business. So it needs to shift to make it not the hard sell,
yeah,
but actually the easy buy.
So moving on then, we've seen kind of the great trend in terms of actually ad buying has been ease of use at scale. And that's why we've seen so many ad alliances. That's why we've seen this kind of shift into programmatic. But has programmatic, in, you know, whether because it was originally kind of this buzzword or because of the inherent sort of issues with it, has that made the kind of the buying and selling process more difficult?
Digital started this, right?
Yeah.
Programmatic accelerated it dramatically. In terms of a devaluation of a publisher's audience,
yep.
It was like, oh, it's okay, we'll just take the remnant, right? And that's where you start. And it's, well, hold on a minute, what's the output of this campaign? What is this campaign trying to achieve? It's trying to influence an audience, and you can't influence an audience by having an ad that doesn't show somewhere. So then they started, then things like viewability started coming into the mix. But unfortunately, the pricing damage had often already been done, and, yeah. and we face this constantly. It's like, well, I'm buying through programmatic, so I only want the same audience in the same spaces, and I want that for £5 CPM, whereas your rate card's, you know, £150 CPM. We see it in a B2B space all the time.
Yeah.
And it's a race to the bottom, and what that does is it limits publishers' abilities to create brand safe, you know, highly relevant premium environments, because you've got the buy side trying to drag prices down below an area which is unsustainable. I think one of the trends that we've, or one of the opportunities all of this technology and not just programmatic provides for publishers is a true ability to understand behaviors better than ever before of how the potential prospect at the end of that advert or that message, and define an advert as a display ad or a bit of content or whatever, or an event even, right?
Yeah.
Behaves and reacts to messages.
The next question has been thrown in by my co-host, Peter. I suspect he threw it in specifically as a drama bomb to try and get a rise out of one. So he's asking, considering all that there are all these issues around advertising and sort of the increasing complexity of it, of advertising kind of as an industry, wouldn't it just be easier to shift across to different revenue streams? So whether that be sort of events or whether that be sponsored?
It's interesting. I think that it reminds me of a phrase of actually a client who had quite a big demand on me when I was a salesperson, actually. And he said to me when I sat down as a fresh-faced salesperson, probably with a hangover, if it was easy, Fergus, everyone would be doing it. It's difficult to monetize an audience, right?
Yeah.
Oh
my God, that might well be the understatement of 2018.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so there we go. I'll throw a world duh statement back at a world duh question. I think what we're seeing more and more of is publishers developing multiple revenue streams seen as traditional revenue streams. And I think that's come from the back of a realization that in order to deliver results, integrated multi-channel campaigns usually deliver way better results for the client. You can add margin in as a business, credibly add margin in as a business if you're joining all that up. The audience gets a better experience because they kind of understand why these messages are being thrown at them. They may well get some value off the back of it, particularly in the B2B space. Really might get some value off the back of it. So I would say as a successful ads business, you need what would have traditionally been seen as these different revenue streams, but you need them joined up. You need them speaking to each other and thinking about that audience and the journey that your clients want to take them on.
And the received wisdom is that B2B publishers have always had this much stronger idea of who the audience is than B2C, where, you know, scale has often been, you know, the goal even before, you know, digital scale was a thing. So have B2B publishers really kept hold of that advantage, and how are they pushing it?
I think it's a mixed bag. My take is that they have an advantage in the sense that they know who their audience is. do they all take advantage of knowing how their audience behave and how to influence them? I think there are some who are starting to see that and starting to really become these trusted advisors for their clients and start to help them make good decisions around that messaging. I don't think we're anywhere near what's possible. I think that we see a lot of companies who are absolutely shouting about getting audience insight, but it isn't around how they make decisions and how they're being influenced. And that's the absolute, I suppose, secret that's out there very openly. That's what we need to be doing, because fundamentally your clients need to be choosing something they believe is going to work. As Fergus said just then, what that means is talking to a sales experience or talking to a person, a salesperson, and getting that sales experience where actually they're learning what works, what doesn't work, how their audience behave, why their audience will say yes, why their audience will say no, and being able to map a recommendation or a proposed campaign to what is going to work for the audience. The answer to your question is I don't think most people take advantage of it in any way like they could. And
really?
Wow,
I would have thought that there would have been, you know, it's an advantage that B2B particularly would be.
It's a massive advantage and opportunity. I would say that a lot don't take advantage of that, because there is still a commonplace belief that what works in sales and marketing is the same as what it used to be. So if you've got the numbers of how many audience members you've got and who they are and what level, that's enough. But actually, it is this shift of, if you now believe that the sales and marketing person's role is to help your client understand why they should do something, and the only reason why they should do something is if it's going to have the right impact on the audience, right?
Yeah.
So getting the salespeople to shift perspective from I'm doing what's right for the client or what the client tells me to do to actually I'm doing what's right for the audience to help the client achieve their goals, there's that shift in perspective is really, really necessary. And I don't think people are taking advantage of it as much as they can, but there are a select few out there who really are, and it's really benefiting, because they're becoming the sales experience where the client is getting real value. CEB talk about it as a sales experience where it's worth paying for in itself, and that means helping that client make decisions that are going to work, and that means work for the audience.
Nice. So what will it take then for the kind of that best practice to become widespread? Is that going to take training? Is it going to take acknowledgement that the rest of the industry is doing it? You know, what's sort of the way to actually get there?
That's been our push for the last 7 years, and it's tough. It's an interesting one, because when at Flume we started shouting about this, there were some really, really savvy people out there who connected to it very early on, and actually when most people see the proof, they buy into it. But there does, for some publishers and companies, seem to be a bit of a head in the sand thing, and it's easy to assume that what worked for you as a sales director 10 years ago is still going to work for your team now. And I don't know what's going to create the change, because we're still quite surprised how few people open their eyes to it. But what I do know is when they do, and when they tap into the fact that the way buyers buy has changed and what works in sales is completely different, and in marketing, it's making a massive, massive difference.
Yeah, it certainly is. My experience of going on a few of these journeys is that there's a period where, you know, you've probably all seen Cotter's cycle of change, right? And there's this bit at the bottom of there. And as you start to change clients and they go through this and they're buying and the business model changes that you've got this real challenge of the having the right conversations. You're generally talking about much larger deals. You're generally helping people sign up, and when it comes through in droves and it's awesome. But there's a period where you have to keep the plane flying while you rebuild it. And that change is really tough. It really is tough. There was a great quote. I was with one of our US clients the other day, and he said they're in the marketing services space. They're selling to marketers. I was chatting to him about, you know, fitting the right solution to the right clients and truly understanding your clients and the right approach to take to them. And he said, well, you see, where we see challenges, and certainly where I've seen challenges with adopting any new approach, is where you have someone who tries to sell a Ferrari to someone who really needs a Buick.
Yeah.
Right. The trick comes in classifying your customers and actually focusing on the ones who absolutely will buy a Ferrari if you get it right, but making sure you're selling an absolute ton of Buicks in the meantime. You should have used Fiat for that example, and that would have actually worked, but you know what I mean.
is an interesting one, and I won't name any names. We were recently in a sales meeting with a potential client. We were up against, not that we met them, but two other training providers, and we got total buy-in from the two people at that meeting, the CRO. What was interesting was afterwards we had a conversation with them after we'd had the discussion and presented to them, and we're talking to the HR director. We said, kind of an age-old sales question, any reservations? And the reservation was so interesting, because the reservation was, well, when I think about the sales team, they're all quite averse to change. And you guys, I totally buy into it. It's absolutely the right stuff. We love the modern stuff. We think this is the right stuff. But part of me is wondering whether we should go with another supplier who, yeah, it might not be quite right, but I think people would be able to accept it easier. And I looked at my business partner and I slightly like, is this a dream? It makes literally no sense at all in my head.
But you're not the path of least resistance.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it's going to be tougher for me to push this through. There's an interesting trend at the moment which is happening, which from one study says that in 2018, less than 50% of B2B salespeople are going to hit their target, right? Which is quite scary. Or maybe reassuring for some people, I don't know. But I see that continuing for a little while, but I also see that changing at some point. There will be a place where, a tipping point where that has to change. And I think that change is where the shift is from selling as much as you can for as much as you can to actually a realization we've got to make this stuff work. The only way to get sustainable growth as a business is if what we're delivering from clients is going to work. Because if it doesn't work for clients, even if you sell it this time, they ain't coming back next time. And so it's that shift of the motivation behind the sales experience. And there are companies already doing this, and there are going to be more and more companies who do this that realize their job is to help clients to interact and influence the audience in the right way and become those audience behavioral experts with a focus on delivering proper results. It needs a shift in mindset, and I think over the next couple of years there's going to be more and more companies who are starting to focus on that and really reap benefits from that.
I don't think we saw that a roadmap there, but I think we've identified a bunch of stops we need to make along the way to actually make kind of advertising as vital and relevant as it could be. But thank you both very much for that. That's been really interesting. Just one final question. We ask all our guests this, and it wouldn't be a Media Voices special unless I did. What was the last piece of media that you watched, read, listened to that really made you feel something on an emotional level?
That's a really tough question. I'm a bit of a geek, so I read a lot. And one of the most recent books, well, no, actually it's not that recent, but one of the ones that really resonates in my head is Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. Probably pronounced his name wrong. Which you probably know about, but fundamentally it's around the way that the brain makes shortcuts, takes shortcuts to perform functions that we think we actually make on our own, and how that can influence everything you do, and essentially you live on autopilot. And having a look through those and being able to define and codify a little bit more about the way my brain works, but also everyone else's, was really enlightening, and I think kind of made me realise how many of those are very, very true of me, and probably increasingly so as I get older and get engrossed in different technologies.
Yeah.
So mine actually, it came as part of a conscious choice. The news recently, constantly, for a long time, has done nothing but make me angry.
Yeah.
Genuinely just angry, generally.
Yeah.
And I'm not an angry person normally. I'm quite an optimist. And I was struggling because I didn't want to obviously stop reading stuff. But you know, there was not even in newspapers, in the, particularly in the digital world, it's very difficult to get that moment of, you know, the squirrel on water skis at the end of the newscast that you used to do. And I tried to find a solution. My sister suggested this. She said, I don't subscribe to any of them anymore. So, you know, she subscribes to the Optimist Daily, right? Which does what it says on the tin.
I'm going to subscribe immediately.
Yeah. And all it does is talk about good stuff that's happened. And none of it's actually, there's not much fluff in there. There's not like, you know, so-and-so's done it. There's actually genuinely good stuff. And there was one that caught my attention the other day, which was after a conversation I was having, which was around water and how, as we go through the next century, water's going to become like a massive water scarcity is going to be a massive issue for people. So some plucky inventor out there, and my daughter flagged this one to me, because she wants to be an inventor, which is awesome to have a daughter that's also wants to be an inventor and I can watch Star Wars with. she pointed this one out to me, which was on the Optimist Daily, and it said that basically some plucky business out there has invented what they call fog nets. Right, so you put fog nets up and they can capture up to 180 litres of water per day out of thin air.
Nice.
Completely. Wow. So desalination plants, you know, are one option.
Yeah.
Which is basically going to have massive nets which capture water out of the air and obviously maybe help solve this problem. So that was one of the things that I got out of the Optimist Daily, and it made me smile on the train, which is an unusual occurrence.
Thank you very much for listening to this Media Voices special sponsored by Flume on the future of advertising. We'd also like to extend our thanks to the London College of Communication for allowing us access to one of their fantastic recording booths. As ever, you can always get in contact with us on @MediaVoicesPod on Twitter or by going to voices.media. Until next time, thank you very much and goodbye. This Media Voices special is sponsored by Flume Training. Flume believe the way clients buy has completely shifted and what works in sales has completely changed. They help media businesses drive sales performance through their high-impact training, coaching, and consultancy.